This is VOA News, coming to you by remote. I'm Gene Randall. Drug maker AstraZeneca says it has gotten the go-ahead from safety watchdogs to resume British clinical trials of its COVID-19 vaccine, one of the most advanced currently in development. The late-stage trials of the experimental vaccine developed with researchers from the University of Oxford were suspended this week after an illness in a study volunteer, casting doubts on an early rollout. French police fired tear gas and arrested more than 200 people in Paris today as yellow vest protesters returned to the streets in force for the first time since the coronavirus lockdown. The yellow vest movement began in late 2018 as a protest against higher fuel taxes and French President Emmanuel Macron's ideas for economic reform. Some of the protesters wore black clothes and carried the flag of an anti-fascist movement, suggesting the presence of radical demonstrators often blamed for violence in earlier street marches. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson today is warning the European Union not to threaten the UK, saying a bill which would breach a divorce treaty with the bloc is needed to protect Britain's integrity. With the EU stepping up plans for trade talks without a Brexit deal, Johnson has accused its negotiators of threatening to impose a food blockade between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland. Said Johnson on Twitter, "Let's make the EU take their threats off the table." British lawmakers Monday are set to begin debating the internal markets bill, which one minister said would violate international law in a very specific but limited way. Could peace talks be in the offing in Afghanistan? That remains to be seen. But Afghan government representatives and Taliban insurgents are formally ushering in the beginning of historic talks aimed at ending two decades of war. Among those on hand in Doha, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who told the participants, "The choice of your political system is yours to make." The actual talks are set to start tomorrow. Top issues in Doha, an immediate ceasefire, and an agreement on protecting women's rights. This is VOA News. Princess Leonor, the 14-year-old heir to the Spanish throne, has gone into quarantine after a classmate tested positive for COVID-19. 8 million Spanish children returned to classes last week, but some schools have closed in the wake of positive tests. Spain reported 4,700 new infections on Friday, pushing its total case count over 566,000. The country's death toll is closing in on 30,000. For the second straight day, India is reporting a record daily jump in new coronavirus infections, 97,570. India is the pandemic's second worst affected country, trailing only the United States, which has more than 6.4 million infections. India's caseload has grown to almost 4.7 million, with 77,000 fatalities. The spread of the virus there is faster than anywhere else in the world, as cases surge through urban and rural areas. The global pandemic numbers from Johns Hopkins University, nearly 28.5 million infections and a death toll of 916,000. Reuters reports there was an air attack in Yemen early today, carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in the capital, Sana'a, which is controlled by Houthi rebels. A Houthi spokesman is quoted as saying there were 9 airstrikes on a military engineering camp and the headquarters of the National Security Apparatus, and apparently targeted a meeting of high-level Houthi leaders. The bombings in Sana'a have been relatively rare since last September, when Saudi Arabia launched indirect talks with the Iran-aligned Houthi movement. Wildfires continue their brutal assault on the American West. The states of California, Oregon, and Washington have lost millions of acres to the flames, and the death count is on the rise. Oregon's Governor Kate Brown says dozens of people are missing in her state. Tens of thousands have been evacuated from their homes. Hundreds of thousands of others have been told to ready themselves for evacuation. Though weather conditions are easing, flames have been threatening areas near Portland and Oregon's capital of Salem. More than 1,500 square miles have been scorched, nearly twice the area affected by fire in a typical year. The major worry now is that two gigantic fires in the state will merge, posing an even greater danger to Oregon's most populated region. In California, there is a search for victims north of San Francisco, as nearly 15,000 firefighters battle more than two dozen blazes across the northern part of the state. The deadliest so far has claimed 9 lives, but 19 people are unaccounted for. Many of the places to be searched remain too hot for rescue teams to enter. And this is just the beginning of the fall fire season. In Washington state, Governor Jay Inslee says flames the last 5 days have made this his state's second worst fire season ever. He blamed the effects of climate change, saying, quote, "This is not an act of God. This has happened because we have changed the climate." More news online at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Gene Randall, and this is VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
With an electoral file audited by a reputable international structure, with many observers in as many polling places as possible, the election can be free and fair, only if these conditions are there.
An Ivorian opposition party endorses former President Henry Konan Bedi as its presidential candidate for the upcoming elections.
We have the gender-based violent actors committee in place. So I believe that collectively, each and every one of us will do his or her responsibility to ensure protection of our citizens in Kaduna State.
Kaduna State Legislature in Nigeria proposes a new measure as punishment for child rape convicts.
Who was in charge of him? Was he held by the Rwanda police? Was he held by intelligence services? Was he sitting in a hotel in Kigali because he had decided to travel there by himself? I don't think they're going to want to go to that detail and to that level about the illegal acts that they carry out against both real and perceived enemies of the country.
And Rwanda denies kidnapping Paul Rusesabagina, a government critic. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Ivory Coast, the opposition party, the Democratic Party of Côte d'Ivoire, African Democratic Rally, plans to officially nominate former President Henry Konan Bedi as its presidential candidate Saturday. However, the party is demanding immediate changes to the leadership of the Electoral Commission. This after expressing concern that the current leadership of the electoral body is biased in favor of incumbent President Alassane Ouattara and his governing party. It also says failure to make the changes to ensure the independence of the electoral body will mean the polls will not be transparent or credible. Jean Yves is a leading member of the opposition party, the Democratic Party of Côte d'Ivoire, African Democratic Rally. He tells me that contrary to report, his party has not threatened to boycott the elections despite its demands for leadership changes at the Electoral Commission before the elections.
Our party is not threatening to boycott the elections. We are simply saying that the conditions are not meet to go to transparent elections. Going to elections under such conditions will undoubtedly lead us to a post-election crisis more serious than that of 2010. We want to avoid that.
So, Jean, why do you want changes at the Electoral Commission as your party is demanding?
Well, the Electoral Commission actually is strongly partial in favor of RHDP. We reported it to African courts on human and people's rights, which ruled on the subject and issued recommendations and injunctions in favor of opposition. All that remains is to apply these recommendations. That's all.
What happens if the demands of changes at the Electoral Commission that your party seek are not met, or the government refuses to make those changes you demand?
In this case, we will be heading straight for a pre-election crisis. All the ingredients are there for us to move toward a serious crisis before the elections. There have already been demonstrations and some victims following the announcement of President Ouattara's candidacy to run for a third anti-constitutional mandate. So I think we will run. We will be heading straight for a pre-election crisis.
Some opposition figures are being prevented from participating in the election. Former President Laurent Gbagbo, as an example, and former Prime Minister Guillaume Soro. What is your party saying about this?
My party say about that it isn't normal. It is unfortunate that we come to this situation coming from RHDP, which justifies its armed rebellion of September 2002 by the fact that the party in power at the time refused to certain candidates to run in election. 20 years later, they are doing the same thing. So they have caused all this suffering, all this victim to regain the same thing. They have caused all this suffering, all these victims to do the same thing. To do the same thing is not normal.
So what is the position of your party regarding the upcoming elections? Do you think the elections will be free, fair, transparent and credible?
No. If the condition if the conditions are the same, no. But with an impartial electoral commission, with an electoral file audited by a reputable international structure, with many observers in as many polling places as possible, the election can be free and fair, only if these conditions are there.
Jean Yves is a leading member of the opposition party, the Democratic Party of Côte d'Ivoire, African Democratic Rally. He spoke with me from Ivory Coast, commercial capital, Abidjan. In Nigeria, the Kaduna State Commissioner for Women's Affairs and Social Development has welcomed a new measure that ensures a convicted rapist of a child under 14 years of age is medically castrated. Hafsat Baba says the new measure will serve as a deterrent to those who rape children in the state. She says she expects Governor Nasir Ahmed El-Rufai to sign the bill into law. She adds that the measure follows demands by residents for a stricter punishment for those convicted of raping children. Nigerian human rights groups have condemned the recent surge in rape cases following the lockdown imposed to limit the spread of the coronavirus. The surge in rape cases forced governors across the country to declare a state of emergency over rape and sexual violence against women. For more reaction about the new measure to stop rape in Kaduna State, I reach Hafsat Baba, the State Commissioner for Women's Affairs and Social Development.
Well, this is a very welcome development. This is progress because people have been advocating for stiffer penalties for rapists. And for the Child Welfare and Protection Law, the penalty is life imprisonment. But in the penal code, it's about 14 years. So people have been asking for stiffer penalty, and then we had to review the penal code and also consider suggestions from people. So at the end of the day, that is what the people want, and this is what it is in the law now.
Hafsat, how are residents in Kaduna reacting to this new measure?
I'm sure they are very excited because a lot of suggestions have been received. And they really want to see that stiffer penalties for rapists, most especially raping of children and babies, because you see that somebody, an adult, will rape a three-month-old baby or a one-year-old child and so on. So we believe that this penalty is okay and everybody is happy about it.
I understand State Governor Nasir Ahmed El-Rufai will now need to sign the bill for it to become law in the state. How soon do you think he will assent this bill, and what's next?
Oh, I'm sure as soon as the bill gets to the table, he will not waste time in signing it because he's also very concerned about the what is happening with our children, how the rape cases have actually gone up. So I'm sure he's not going to waste time.
There was a recent surge in sexual-related violence, including rape and violence against women, which the governors agreed was a state of emergency. Do you think that necessitated this move by the National House of Assembly?
Absolutely. You see, we've experienced increase in our data, especially during the COVID-19 lockdown. So we're looking at why are we having such cases happening. That is why we even had to construct the four sexual assault referral centers that we have in Kaduna so that people can access health services, most especially those that are being raped. But now with a little bit of the relaxation of the lockdown, we are working seriously to ensure that we bring the number down, and we have to work with all the stakeholders, all the ministry, department and agencies to ensure that we bring that those figures down.
Do you think this will serve as a deterrent to those who will engage in such acts?
Personally, I believe that it will actually serve as a deterrent. And secondly, you know, there is no hope for that person who is going to be castrated. Unlike when, if the person is in prison, maybe he may likely have state pardon or federal government pardon, you know, after service for some years or, and so on. But I believe the castration, that is a stiffer penalty, and that is what the people are actually asking for.
As a women's state commissioner in Kaduna, what do you think the message is here regarding this new measure that has been approved by the Kaduna State Assembly?
Well, the message here is that we'll ensure implementation of the law, and I'm sure that the courts and the security agencies, they will arrest perpetrators, they will investigate, and then the courts will also prosecute. But I'm also sending a message to everybody in Kaduna State that despite the fact that this law has been signed, but it is our responsibility as parents to ensure that we protect our children. For the government, we'll try our very best to ensure that protection, because we have the Child Welfare and Protection Law in place. And then we also have the Child Protection Network in place. We have the Gender-Based Violent Actors Committee in place. So I believe that collectively, each and every one of us will do his or her responsibility to ensure protection of our citizens in Kaduna State.
Hafsat Baba is the Kaduna State Commissioner for Women's Affairs and Social Development. She spoke with me from Kaduna, Northern Nigeria. Still in Nigeria, the Association of Resident Doctors says it has yet again suspended its indefinite strike action aimed at pressuring the government to meet their demands. Dr. Aliyu Sakumba says the doctors made the decision to suspend the strike after government representatives said they would meet the strikers' demands. The doctors embarked on a strike on Monday after accusing the government of failing to meet their demands despite repeated promises to do so. Core among their demands, Dr. Sakumba says, is for the administration to ensure the prompt payment of their salaries and for the government to stop security agencies from harassing members. Critics say the on-again, off-again strike is undermining healthcare delivery and jeopardizing the lives of patients. They also say they don't think the government is not taking the doctors seriously. Dr. Sakumba tells me the suspension of the strike will allow members of the group to determine the next line of action.
The Nigerian Association of Resident Doctors had a meeting with the government stakeholders, and we were able to extract some commitments from the government to address our concerns. And as the government had requested for a period of 2 weeks to get those concerns addressed, and we have decided to grant the request. And so we are suspending the strike to give government the 2 weeks they have requested for to see that these concerns are addressed. And we are hoping that they will do as they have promised, they have requested for, after which we shall be having a review meeting to know if actually our demands are met or not.
This is not the first time you have met officials or representatives of the government, and negotiations seem to be progressing, but your main concerns are not addressed because you said they drag their feet or they are not sincere. What is different this time?
Well, the thing is, at every point in time, we keep getting the blackmail that we cannot afford to be on strike while waiting, and we are almost always blackmailed into submission, and we almost always tell them that we will suspend the strike to give them the benefit of the doubt. And this time around, this time is no exception, because we feel that remaining on strike for the 2 weeks period for which they have told us categorically that they will not be able to address the concerns before then will mean that we are just making Nigerians suffer and suffer. So we have called off the strike again, hoping that this time around they will consider our plight significant enough to deserve their attention to get them addressed. There's actually nothing different from what the government have been demonstrating over the years, but we have taken their words again, as we will always do, and give them the benefit of the doubt and hope that they are going to address our concerns differently this time around.
What do you say to critics of yours who say that your association is not being serious and that you come out, announce a strike to pressure the government to address your concerns, you meet officials of the government, then you suspend the strike, you go to negotiations, and this is a vicious cycle that goes on and on? How do you respond to such criticism?
Well, I would, Nigerian patients, would they prefer that we remain on strike perpetually while government address our concerns, or they would prefer that we suspend them at least to create a period of so-called and relief for them? Whichever way Nigerians want it, we'll call that peace. As long as our demands are germane and reasonable, and we think they are worth shutting down, we will shut down. And as long as we keep getting responses and commitment from government, because we are reasonable people, we will suspend the strike. And we believe whatever we do in the best interest of Nigerians and the Nigerian patients specifically. We basically suspend the strike because we feel that there should be a relief, and we should be reasonable, and that's the basis for the suspension.
Well, that is what I heard from Nigerians who are saying that, why don't you stick to your guns until your demands are met? Because if you want your concerns to be addressed, then you cannot be naive. Nigerians should not suffer because of what they described as the naivety of doctors to extract the demands that they are making from the government.
Well, then if that is the request of Nigerians, then that is taken and noted, and perhaps subsequently we will not have any cause to suspend the strike and until our demands are met.
What message do you have for the people of Nigeria following the suspension of the strike?
The message I have for the people of Nigeria is the fact that Nigerians don't hold their government responsible for anything, and instead hold the helpless citizens, like the resident doctors that we are responsible. Instead of the Nigerian people demanding that the Nigerian government do everything in their position to address the concerns and ensure service delivery is restored, they rather concentrate on those who are victims of the decisions of the Nigerian government. So I think that should change. Nigerian people should begin to hold government responsible, not just on healthcare delivery issues, but on all aspects of their life. When things are not going well, they should learn to hold the government responsible. They have voted in to ensure that things work. And when they don't work, the government should be blamed instead and held responsible. And perhaps that way, the government should be able to sit up and do what is expected of them.
Dr. Aliyu Sakumba is the leader of the Nigerian Association of Resident Doctors. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Rights Watch is calling on the Rwandan government to provide a full account of how Paul Rusesabagina arrived in the country. This after the family said Mr. Rusesabagina will not willingly return to Rwanda. They allege that he was kidnapped in Dubai shortly after he arrived in the United Arab Emirates. Louise Murch, the Human Rights Watch Central African director, says Rusesabagina was held for 3 days before the announcement of his arrest. He says that shows that the government committed an illegal act described as enforced disappearance. But Rwandan President Paul Kagame has rejected criticisms that Paul Rusesabagina was kidnapped. To learn more about the calls for the Rwandan government to fully disclose how Rusesabagina arrived in Rwanda, I reached Louise Murch, the Human Rights Watch Central African director.
The fact that they decided to illegally and unlawfully exfiltrate Rusesabagina from Dubai, as it's appearing that is the case, and we are calling this an enforced disappearance, suggests that Rwanda did not want to go through official channels. This is not a comment whatsoever on some of Rusesabagina's comments that have been made over the last couple of years. But they have decided to do this unlawfully. He was missing from August 27th to August 31st. There's a huge question mark around where he was, the conditions of detention, who he was allowed to communicate with. It certainly wasn't his lawyers, and it certainly wasn't his family members. And that constitutes an unlawful enforced disappearance in which the individual was held incommunicado. And Rwanda not only practices these types of abductions, but Rwanda also has a clear and delineated track record with regards to torture, with regards to threats and pressure to make people confess to crimes, especially crimes of terrorism, of which Rusesabagina is charged.
Well, Louis, President Paul Kagame denied that Paul Rusesabagina had been kidnapped. And he said he got here on the basis of what he believed he wanted to do, and he found himself here. It is like you are dialing somebody you want to talk to and find that you have called the wrong number. That is how it happened. It was actually flawless from what I heard, unquote. What do you make of his rebuttal that Paul Rusesabagina was not kidnapped?
Well, it wasn't flawless. It was unlawful. If Rusesabagina was somehow tricked into going to Kigali, which may have happened, and he was arrested upon entering the country, they should have announced his arrest. He should have been given access to family members via telephone, but more importantly, legal counsel of his choosing and consular officers, because he is a citizen of Belgium. The days in which this individual was completely missing and had been disappeared are not flawless. They are unlawful.
Paul Rusesabagina has announced his support for the FNL, which has carried out armed attacks and is described as a terrorist organization by Rwanda. Some supporters of the Rwandan Patriotic Front say that the government is mandated by the constitution to protect life and property. So if there's an individual undermining the territorial integrity of Rwanda, as well as undermining the social fabric, peace and stability in Rwanda, the government has to act. And that is what the government is doing. How do you respond to that?
I would agree with that assertion that the government has to act. What the government should not be doing is the government of Rwanda is continuing to do this through unlawful and illegal means. We talk about the FNL attacks in our communique, and I want to be very clear. We are putting a spotlight on the process in which Rusesabagina was unlawfully disappeared and brought to Rwanda. We are not making much comments on the fact that he has declared his unreserved support to a group that has perpetrated and openly admitted perpetrating attacks in southern Rwanda. But there has to be methods and means which conform to legal standards whereby to get someone back into the country. And simply tricking or grabbing an individual out of Dubai and holding them in an undisclosed location for a number of days completely undermines any credible judicial process that will follow. Moreover, you have in President Kagame's press conference, you basically have the verdict already handed down on Rusesabagina through what Kagame was saying. This is a country where, on politically sensitive cases such as this, the judiciary is not independent, and you've already had Kagame announce that Rusesabagina is guilty, that he has blood on his hands, so it's not going to be a surprise to see him go away.
Do you think the government will explain how Paul Rusesabagina arrived in Rwanda?
I don't think they will, Peter, and I don't think they will because they're going to have to explain where he was held for a number of days before August 31st. If they do explain that, they will admit that they illegally held an individual incommunicado. Now, this is something that happens in Rwanda often, and they continue to deny it. So if they say, yes, we did get him on the 27th out of Dubai, we did trick him, or we did grab him, then they will have to account for the 27th all the way to the 31st. The plane was not in the air for that time. I have flown from Kigali to Dubai. It is not a four-day flight. So they're going to have to explain what actually happened, where he was held, who was in charge of him. Was he held by the Rwanda police? Was he held by intelligence services? Was he sitting in a hotel in Kigali because he had decided to travel there by himself? I don't think they're going to want to go to that detail and to that level about the illegal acts that they carry out against both real and perceived enemies of the country. This is something that happens often, and they are not going to want to have that in the conversation.
Louis Mudge is the Human Rights Watch Central African Director. He spoke with me from Vermont here in the United States. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo says it has resumed protection of Panzi Hospital and the patients and staff working there. The hospital, which is located in Bukavu, is where Dr. Denise Mukwege, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, treats rape victims and other patients. Matthias Gilman, a spokesman for the UN mission in the DRC, says there was a scale back after some of the peacekeepers protecting the hospital tested positive to the coronavirus. The resumption of the deployment of the peacekeepers to the hospital has been welcomed by rights and civil society groups. This following reports that Dr. Mukwege's personal safety has been threatened. MONUSCO spokesperson Matthias Gilman tells me that the UN mission is also working with the DRC government to train the local police to help bolster security at the hospital.
It's been years since we've been supporting and providing security through dedicated peacekeepers to the hospital. During the COVID crisis in May, parts of our soldiers who were affected to come to the clinic were found positive. So we had to isolate them and we had to temporarily suspend their duty at Panzi Clinic. We have now resumed this support under the understanding that obviously the providing international security is very important because we're very committed to the security of Dr. Mukwege and his hospital. But we do need to work towards a more sustainable solution. And this requires us to continue working, developing the national capacity of the Congolese police because, ultimately the security of the Congolese citizens is the primary responsibility of Congolese authorities. The Congolese authorities have expressed their will to provide security for Dr. Mukwege and his hospital. So we hope to be working very soon. We are working already on an arrangement, a security arrangement with the local authorities to ensure that the adequate security is provided.
Now, talking about working with the government to bolster security currently with the view of entrenching the developmental capacity of the DRC government capacity to protect the Panzi Hospital, how far do you think this engagement will go in terms of ensuring that security is bolstered to protect life and property, particularly when MONUSCO is involved?
We have trained already 30 Congolese police, and we'll continue to develop their skills to make sure that they can take over once it's possible and once a security arrangement agreeable to everybody can be found. Until then, the training of local police is obviously something that is core to our mandate, and so we look forward to working with the parties involved to make sure that we can find the adequate security arrangements for the hospital and for Dr. Mukwege.
Now, with the resumption of this 8-year security process that you have been providing for the Panzi Hospital and some parts of the DRC, do you think that this will help perhaps prevent attempt or threat of attacks against the hospital and perhaps by extension Dr. Mukwege and the health workers there?
We have been providing security for the Panzi Clinic I think at least over the past 8 years, I think since 2013 or 2012. So, I don't think this will create any kind of new situation. It's not a new situation. It was temporarily suspended because of cases of COVID where we had to isolate are peacekeepers, obviously for them not to propagate the virus, and now they're back at work.
So, Dr. Mukwege, we understand, expressed concern that there were people threatening to attack him, his life is in danger. So I want to find out if the UN could help the government, in this case, MONUSCO helping the government in protecting the health workers in Panzi Hospital, because most of them spend their life, their day there anyway, particularly during this case of the global pandemic caused by the coronavirus.
Well, that's what we are doing. We are providing security for the Panzi Clinic because we are committed to his security and the security of the hospital, where the very important work that he's doing is done. So we are playing our part. Regarding the threats, we have expressed our concern through the UN Human Rights Commissioner, and the Congolese authorities will need to launch an investigate this threat, and our human rights colleagues on the ground, you know, can support should the Congolese authorities make the wish for us to do so. But we are playing our part in providing security for the Panzi Clinic as much as we need within our limited means.
Matthias, before we leave, what is the message of MONUSCO to the people who work in the Panzi Clinic surrounding areas, particularly when local media reports that there were plans or threats on the lives of those who work there?
MONUSCO remains committed to supporting within our means the very important work that is being done in the Panzi Clinic and around. We are taking the measures necessary to ensure that we can provide security, and we are looking forward to working, in finding a more sustainable arrangement whereby the National Congolese Police will be empowered and will be able to provide the necessary security for the Panzi Clinic, but obviously, you know, beyond for the population of Congo.
Matthias Gilman is a spokesperson for the UN peacekeeping mission in the DRC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kinshasa. UN and international agencies are stepping up emergency operations in response to deadly flooding in Sudan, which has left hundreds of thousands homeless. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission says more than 500,000 people have been affected by the worst flooding in the country in at least 100 years. It expects the number of people needing help to reach 750,000. The commission reports dozens of people have lost their lives. More than 100,000 houses have been destroyed or damaged. Agricultural land is underwater and unusable, and thousands of livestock have been killed. The International Red Cross Federation calls the magnitude of the flooding disaster unprecedented. It says teams of Red Crescent volunteers are helping people move to higher ground. The organization is appealing for $12 million to provide emergency shelter, safe drinking water, food, and other essential needs for at least 200,000 of the most vulnerable people. And the World Health Organization warns of an outbreak of waterborne and vector-borne diseases such as dengue, chikungunya, malaria, and measles. WHO spokeswoman Fadela Shaib says the UN body has delivered supplies to prevent and control those diseases. She tells VOA that the WHO also is taking measures to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
We have sent diagnostic tests, laboratory equipment. We have helped in training technicians and doctors to recognize symptoms on COVID and how to help patients. We have also disseminated a lot of information, including in the language of Sudan, Arabic.
The World Health Organization reports at least 13,439 coronavirus cases, including 833 deaths in Sudan. Shaib says the country's health system suffers from years of underfunding, staff shortages, lack of equipment, medicine, and supplies. She says the WHO is working to fill in the gap. The Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs oversees humanitarian operations by aid agencies. It also manages the Sudan Humanitarian Fund, a country-based fund to which donors contribute money to carry out the flood-related programs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda's Communications Commission is seeing a public backlash and a court challenge after issuing a notice this week requiring anyone wishing to publish information online to first be licensed. The UCC gave the public until October 5 to register for a license. A court petition filed Thursday calls the notice unconstitutional and against freedom of expression. As Halima Tumari reports for VOA from Kampala, critics say it also appears the regulation is aimed at controlling information ahead of next year's elections.
Ugandan blogger Ruth Aine has for years worked with young people who are using technology and social media to bring about change. Through her work, she has tackled issues on women, society, development, politics, and connecting young people to parliament. But now, the Uganda Communications Commission is demanding Aine and other social media users get a license to publish information and broadcasts online. In a notice, the commission says the new regulations covers blogs, television, radio, newspaper, video on demand, internet radio, and internet television, among other services provided to the public. Aine spoke to VOA.
It's just a way of restrict the number of people that are able to have conversations online, but they also want to know who is saying what and where they're saying it from. The other way is that they're just looking for money, the way that they introduce the OTT tax on social media.
Amnesty International Director for East and Southern Africa, Dipros Muchena, has described the new regulation as a blow to freedom of expression and access to information before the 2021 elections. Human rights lawyer Ivan Bowie petitioned the High Court Thursday to quash the regulation, which he says limits the right to engage in civic activities and civic duties.
UCC wants to make us believe that other online users are going to be protected by what they are saying. That notice is a violation of constitutionally guaranteed rights. I would also want an injunction by court to UCC and all state institutions not to fine, arrest or prosecute anyone who is considered to be in violation of that notice.
The Uganda Communications Commission says the online users subject to the regulation have until October 5th to obtain permission. UCC spokesperson Ibrahim Bosa says this is the third time the notice is being posted since 2018, and he says the regulation only targets online users who are being paid for published content.
So our energies right now is to create sensitization, is to be able to engage on areas of clarity. We are now offering an opportunity for any youthful, young, creative Ugandan to get in the business of broadcasting as a business, much as you're doing it on an online platform, and the regulator is aware. If you're doing it as a hobby, then we have nothing to do with you.
According to the UCC, anyone who violates the regulation faces a fine of $135 and up to a year in prison. The commission notes anyone who seeks to change the rule must do so through an amendment in parliament. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Fantastic. Baby, you know you'll be elastic. Baby, you'll be be simply bombastic, fantastic, even spite-tastic.
For you, you're not ready at all. Ready. for you. This the love I got for you. Sura sauti mlokole Nisha mcheze shapatu Naweka mwenge wakula nale Minangangana kujenga mwenzangu anaribu Yasnura madiangana yaona kila siku Abadilisha waganga niroge niwe bubu Kushikiana mapanga ugombi sio ishu Simwezi nitue Kwani na bara wanazotetesi Uwe kipara mawakwi terasi Umba gumbala bora mpoze keshi Aniuwe Nitue 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 Haibu Nitue Nitue Kanyandama
was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the same sun that melts wax is also capable of hardening clay. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.